The Guardian.
You're listening to a Guardian Live event. The Guardian has always been a community of readers, journalists, and contributors. And now our live events are bringing these people together.
The Guardian events are The Guardian at its best, which is a two-way conversation involving the reader and having a real, genuine, thriving debate.
Could be anything from food and culture, arts, to politics, to foreign affairs. Guardian members can attend from the very serious to the quite frivolous.
Support The Guardian's independent journalism and experience it firsthand. To see what events are coming up and to check out the benefits of membership, go to members.theguardian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Live podcast, dedicated to all our live events. This Guardian Live event, Is the UN Still Fit for Purpose?, was recorded at The Guardian, London in October 2015. Here's the chair, Guardian Foreign News Editor, Mark Rice-Oxley.
Hello everyone, good evening. Welcome to this Guardian Live event about the future of the United Nations. For those of you who don't know me, my name's Mark Rice-Oxley. I'm the Guardian's Head of Special Projects. And for those of you who do know me, well, I'm still Mark Rice-Oxley. I'm just going to make a few introductory remarks about the evening, and then I'm going to introduce our panel, most of whom are here. There's one late arrival. We'll get to him in a minute. So this event really came a few months ago. We were sort of sitting around, as news editors do all day long, discussing sort of the big issues facing the world: Syria, Ukraine, Ebola, refugees, poverty, inequality. And it struck us that, you know, these are not only all issues that the UN is heavily engaged with, but they're all issues that the UN's really been struggling to resolve or to get any traction into. And so we thought, as it's the United Nations 70th birthday this autumn, we thought we'd do a big series on, was the UN still fit for purpose, and what's the point of the UN? And with support from our partners at the Gates Foundation, we drew up a package of work, which you may have seen on the site through September. And this event tonight is really the culmination of it all. So without any further ado, let me introduce you to the panel. To my left is Harriet Grant, a journalist who worked with me on the project and something of an expert in the field of humanitarian aid. Next to her, Julian Borgia, former Guardian foreign correspondent and currently diplomatic editor and really a proper expert in the field of global security. Further along, Natalie Samarasinghe, who's the executive director of UNA UK, a charity providing independent analysis on the UN. And Charles Petrie, who's a former assistant secretary general of the United Nations and has plenty of on-the-ground experience of leading UN missions around the world. And finally, perfect timing, Anthony Lowenstein is an author and a journalist who's currently, I think, working on a documentary about disaster capitalism. And I guess we'll find out a bit later how that might tie in with the UN. So what we're going to do, we'll hear briefly from the panel. We'll have a little discussion up here amongst ourselves about some of these issues. But as soon as possible, we want to throw it out to the audience, because I know that there are, you know, there are some people with stories to tell, people who know probably much more about this than I do. And anyway, you're the people who've paid to come, so you're the guys who really should be doing most of the talking. So Harriet, if I could start with you, perhaps you could tell us a bit about some of the things we found as we worked through this project, particularly in terms of the UN budget, the amount of money it spends, and where the resources are lacking.
Yeah, so we started off with a question which seemed it might be impossible to answer, which was, how much has the UN spent in 70 years? A huge question. We did actually find out, $500 billion, which obviously is in some ways a meaningless sum unless we know where that money is going. And one thing that we also found out was that the budget now is, even allowing for inflation, 40 times more than it was when in 1948. So we can see from that the UN has grown and grown and grown. And one thing that we found that isn't working is that the humanitarian parts of the UN claim that they're not getting the money that they need out of all these billions and billions of dollars that are paying for the UN. So there's a system which some people in the UN claim is leaving the bureaucrats in New York with all the money they need, to fund their offices of outer space affairs. That's one of the bodies we looked at. Whereas the people in UNICEF, the WHO, the World Food Programme, who are feeding people, running refugee camps, educating children, didn't have enough money to provide even the most basic of services. And there really is a crisis, whatever way you look at it. The question is why that's happening. And in very briefly, the way the UN budget works is countries pay according to what they can afford related to their GNP into a regular budget and into the peacekeeping budget. But these agencies don't get any of that money, which might seem bizarre to people outside of the UN. These agencies are raising their money year in, year out, like a charity would, going out cap in hand and fundraising. And the outcome of that is that they are massively underfunded. Syrian refugees have had their rations cut. African refugees have had their rations cut. Iraqi clinics have shut down, health services all over the country. So something isn't working. And according to the humanitarians, they need more money. Can it come from cuts in other parts? It's such a huge sum of money that probably not. I know that Charles here, who has done a lot of work on the ground, is perhaps more sceptical about the claims by the humanitarians that all they need is more money, that things will work. So that's the problem, and I'm sure we'll find out more when he speaks later.
Thanks, Harriet. Julian, the Security Council is perhaps the centrepiece of UN architecture, one of the first bits of the UN that was set up, and it's the thing that we hear most about when we're talking about the conflicts around the world. But you look at Syria, Libya, Iraq, you look at Ukraine, Sri Lanka, all these recent conflicts, the UN Security Council has kind of been unable to find any kind of unified decision. Does that mean it's redundant as a decision-making body?
Well, I mean, each of the members, we went to go and talk to all the permanent representatives, and the first thing they said is, we've never passed so many resolutions in the whole history of the Security Council. They do manufacture huge numbers of resolutions, mostly, I think, 70-80% are about Africa, which is somewhere where they can sort of all agree on, and they don't have pressing strategic issues that clog the system up. But the obvious failure has been Syria, this vast civil war, 11-12 million people displaced, terrible death toll, and you've had the four Russian vetoes, which makes it look like the Cold War all over again. And this, of course, has brought back to the surface all the long-standing complaints about the Security Council, which is it is a snapshot of what the world looked like in the aftermath of 1945. It's a very different world. Lots of countries queuing to get on to the council and become, the Germans, the Brazil, South Africa, India, of course, Japan. But the trouble is that the five winners of the Second World War created a system that makes it really hard to change. They can, in effect, veto any change. Some members say, "Oh, well, we're of course in favour of expanding," knowing that Russia and China and the US will stop it. And even if they don't stop it, because you could get 2/3 in the General Assembly and go round the P5 in that way, but there are different views on what reform should look like. There is a kind of jealous neighbour syndrome where all the countries who are the neighbours of the candidate countries have grouped together to make a blocking minority to stop reform happening. So reform is not likely to happen. And in any case, it would not resolve this great power conflict that is at the heart of the impasse over Syria. I mean, there is a school of thought that maybe this impasse is not as inevitable as it seems, and that in a way it is the aftermath of Libya, where everyone did agree that all possible measures should be used to protect civilians, and the Russians, Chinese, but also many other members thought that the West sort of took this piece of paper, ran with it, and went far further in Libya than had been intended. And what I found going to see the various permanent members is the bitterness of Libya really does hang over Security Council and poisons the Syria debate.
Mm, that's really interesting. Natalie, as part of our project, we unearthed some uncomfortable truths for the UN, you know, a Security Council that can't do security, peacekeepers that can't keep the peace, a World Health Organization that just made matters worse when it came to Ebola in West Africa. Shouldn't we just do away with the whole lot and start again?
I probably wouldn't, you know, disagree actually with many of the criticisms in your series. I actually just wanted to start off by picking up on Harriet's point about cost. And you said, you know, half a trillion over 70 years, that's a huge figure. And of course, we need to put that into context of what the UN's been doing. But I think we also need to put that into context of, you know, similar figures in general. For me, I think if the UN works effectively, and that is a big if, half a trillion dollars over 70 years doesn't sound like such a bad deal to me for what it is actually trying to achieve. If you think about what we spend every year on military expenditure, that's 1.8 trillion a year. What we spend on fossil fuel subsidies, that's 5 trillion a year. You know, $500 billion over 70 years, 7 billion a year, that is about what British people spend on takeaway each year. So I just wanted to put those figures into a little bit of context. But what would be lost? What would be lost really is a lifeline for millions of people who are fed, sheltered and protected by the UN every day. The World Food Programme reaches around 90 million a year. The Refugee Agency has helped tens of millions restart their lives. Peacekeepers, there have been failings, but they have also protected thousands in places where really I think the key point is others did not want to go and weren't able to go. So when we dismiss the UN, we're dismissing an organisation that is really, for many people, the difference between life and death. I think we're also dismissing an organisation that has served us in probably more ways than we even realise, from creating the sort of international system of laws and norms on everything from human rights to biodiversity, to really, I suppose, trying to address this fundamental question of what went wrong after the Second World War. That's what the UN represents. It is our attempt, however imperfect, to try and deal with that and say we need to create something better. It was an aspirational response, looking at creating a more peaceful, prosperous world for everyone, but it was also a very pragmatic response, looking at, you know, the benefits of cooperation and weighing those against the downsides of compromise and the heavy cost of war. So I think it's the whole international system that, particularly in the UK, has delivered a lot of stability and prosperity that we would be dismissing and losing without the UN. And this sort of idea of an international community, we now think there is an international community that needs to respond to things, that needs to come together to talk about problems and solve them. So the very fact that when we see a crisis and we say, oh, what's the UN doing? And we often say so very critically, to me, that actually represents the fact that we think the UN ought to be doing something, and that's what we're turning to. And it remains, for all its imperfections, that fundamental universal platform. I think, you know, I think we in the UK and the West have become really accustomed to the UN providing this sort of minimal level of assistance overseas. And what that's done is that it stopped crises that could have had an impact on our lives from spilling over. So actually, we've benefited greatly from that. And now, with the system under increasing strain, we're really seeing that it does have an impact, and these things are affecting us with UN agencies running out of money. So I think, of course, the UN can and should do better. I come from Sri Lanka. It's a country that has seen some of the best of the UN in terms of individuals who've been, you know, trying to protect people on the ground and contributed to development. But it's also, you know, seen one of the worst failures of the UN. And it's a failure of the UN system, of individuals in that system. But ultimately, as Julian was saying, these are political failures. It's governments that call the shots at the UN. So when we say usually the UN has failed us, what we often really mean is our government has failed us and our governments have failed us collectively.
Thanks very much, Natalie. Now, Charles, you have a long and illustrious UN career behind you. Maybe you could just sketch out at this point what you think are some of the things that still work well and some of the things that don't.
I think you've answered the question. I think the value of the UN has been to set standards and norms and legislation, legislating sort of how the international community interacts with people among themselves. I think definitely the UN has been at the forefront of providing different services, the vaccination campaigns, the different activities of the different UN agencies. There, I think in terms of that side of the UN's action, the world has changed fundamentally since 9/11. And the perception of the UN as an impartial, neutral actor is no longer what it was before. And I think what we see on the ground are actually the NGOs doing the work. NGOs, local civil society, local organizations. And I think the UN organizations still have to adapt to that reality. And the reality is that they're no longer on the coalface. They can't be because of the security risk they need to assume to do it. And that, I think, is part of the problem of the UN right now. A lot of these organizations, they need to rethink exactly what is their added value, what is their role on the ground, and also be a little bit more humble, and understand that it's actually the others who are doing the work. And if the others are doing the work and your support, then you need to better understand how you can support. So that's it. Successes of the UN, UN-type actions, probably very strange to use as an example, but I would think Burundi is a success. And the success in Burundi today is that ethnic violence has not exploded, that it remains political violence. And I think Burundi is probably one of the, I was in Rwanda during the genocide. I was the deputy humanitarian coordinator for the UN. And that level of ethnic hatred, is when you're in the middle of it and genocide, you can't see a way out of it. It is so ingrained. Every single individual in that context has suffered and is dealing with its own with their individual suffering. To see a country, I was in 2010, I was in Burundi as the UN representative, to see elections that are contested on political grounds rather than ethnic grounds is a dramatic transformation of violence. Violence still exists, but it's, and there's hope. You can find some sort of, if it's linked to politics and power, you can find some sort of compromise. What I think is amazing about Burundi today is that it hasn't gone, it's incredibly violent, it's awful, but it hasn't gone back into that. And that, I think, is to the credit of the Arusha process, the UN's involvement. But I think, and taking your point, I think the real question about the UN is should one do away with the UN, reinvent it? I mean, if reinventing is an option, possibly worth thinking about, but that's not it. But should one do away with the UN is, I think it's more the question of where did the UN come from? And the UN, like the League of Nations, came out of trauma. Two traumatic events in the last century that led leaders, enlightened leaders, to understand that nation states in themselves and in interacting among themselves could not manage the slide towards these traumatic events. And what was needed was some sort of body that, at a minimum, relativized the individual interests of nation states. So losing the UN, not having the UN is risks. I mean, not having the UN is taking away that additional structure of geopolitics that does allow a certain resolution of conflicts. The question I ask myself, and that's where I think does become crucial for the UN, when you look at the international community, is the spirit of the international community today accommodate, or is it the same as existed at the end of the First and the Second World War? And I would say no. I mean, I would question that, and I would question whether there's that same level of that same spirit today that existed then. I think the spirit today is far more sort of a spirit of coalitions and this idea of a overarching entity that one needs to turn to, accommodate, to deal with problems, I think is not as strong if it exists at all today. Which then, you know, the question, and that's part of the debate, is the UN capable of taking up this challenge right now? I would argue no, because of, and we can go through sort of the current weaknesses of the UN that does not allow. But does the UN have the capacity to take up this challenge? I would say yes, mm-hmm. with some very specific actions.
Charles, thanks very much. And finally, let's bring Anthony in. So you're doing some work at the moment on disaster capitalism. Is the UN part of the problem or part of the solution there?
Well, what I've been doing in the last year is I have a book out called Disaster Capitalism and doing a film on the same subject, looking at, I guess, organisations, corporations, individuals who are making money from misery. That's mostly private organisations, but the UN is undeniably part of that, and I think part of that problem. I wouldn't say the UN shouldn't exist. It's almost a weird question on the one hand, because in so many places around the world, if the UN disappeared tomorrow, there would undeniably be greater suffering in many areas. I've spent this year, for example, in South Sudan, which is one of the largest UN missions in the world. South Sudan is a failed state. It essentially was established in 2011 as the world's newest nation, and it's collapsed. The UN is there, many NGOs are there, and the country hasn't failed because of the UN. But if the UN was not there providing food, support, aid to countless people, the situation would be worse. The question in a place like South Sudan, though, and how that relates to disaster capitalism is, do we feel comfortable as a wealthier Western part of the world that the UN and others prop up nations? Essentially, that's what the UN routinely does. Do we feel comfortable with the UN essentially being governments? That's how it works, and that's what essentially they are doing. South Sudan has a government, but it's run by war criminals, sadly, who are empowered by many other nations, and that is a deep issue. So one of the things over the last years I've been doing is going to various countries around the world, Afghanistan, Haiti, Papua New Guinea, where the UN has a large role. So in Haiti, it's almost one of the worst examples of the UN. For those who don't know, there was a horrific earthquake there in 2010. There were 200,000 people or so who died. The UN had forces before the earthquake, but sent many more. The Nepalese forces who came brought cholera. And about 9,000 Haitians have died. About 175,000 Haitians have suffered from cholera but have not died. And the UN fundamentally, despite a number of attempts by legal groups in Haiti and the US, doesn't even take responsibility for dealing with that issue. Putting aside the numerous examples of UN peacekeepers in Africa raping children and women, I mean, the evidence is overwhelming for that. So to me, it's not really a question of should the UN not exist. It does exist. Can it reform? I'd agree with you. I think fundamentally the major powers have no interest in doing so. And when we talk about this term, it is routinely used, international community. That basically means the handful of Western powers who make decisions. It doesn't mean, say, Burundi making decisions on the global stage. It doesn't work that way. When the press, of which I am a part, uses that term, it means the US and maybe a handful of other nations who might follow, in my view, their lead. So the problem really is when you have the UN mixed with NGOs and other for-profit organisations in a place like Haiti, when an earthquake happens or a disaster strikes or a war happens, the truth is that the UN and far too many UN workers are on far too high salaries. Let's just talk about that right now. It's an important point that when Haiti happens and an earthquake explodes there, the truth is that the majority of money that the US government was giving for aid stayed in America with US contractors. That's what disaster relief often means. And countless Haitians and Afghans and many others will say, we're told that there's billions of dollars here in the mix. And there is, but we're not seeing it. And in Afghanistan and in Iraq, that has fueled the insurgency. I've spent time there and people have said that directly. It fuels it. They're justifiably pissed off with the money that apparently is coming to help them is not there. So the UN exists and it's not about to disappear tomorrow, but I fear that there is not really a great deal of incentive and there's too much self-interest of within the UN establishment to maintain itself to be a quasi, often unaccountable government on its own, because that's what the UN essentially has become. It's a global government with very few accountability mechanisms that work.
I'm just going to ask you one question before I throw it out to everybody else. How much does this all come back to leadership, the Secretary General, and the process by which he, because it is always a he, or it has been so far. Is selected, and perhaps the corollary to that is, if we got someone who was tough and independent and looked at all this bloated bureaucracy, this overlap, these expensive people sitting in New York sucking up the money, I mean, would that be a start towards reform? Let's start with Natalie.
Yes, I think it would. I mean, I think a lot of the issues that Anthony raised, which I don't agree with, we have to remember what actually falls under the UN's own remit and what member states are meddling with. And that can be everything from putting their own nationals into key positions at the UN, how salaries are pegged. I mean, a lot of that is actually perpetuated by member states. In peacekeeping, the UN needs to do more to set standards and just, I think, be brave and say, no, we won't accept troops from a particular country, although it's usually desperate to have troops. But again, troops on the ground are not actually really under the command of the UN. They are really responsible ultimately to the member states. So, you know, it sounds terrible to be passing the buck back to member states, but that is the way the UN is set up. I do think the Secretary General, though, that said, is an important figure as a figurehead, as a symbol for people. People relate to the person, you know, that they see as a voice for all those, you know, marginalized. Talked about the international community just being a few states. I think ultimately the UN is also a buffer against that. It is that platform where Burundi and other states can come and talk. But at the moment, the way the Secretary General is selected makes him, and sadly it has always been a him until now, very beholden to those powers. It's a process that happens with no job description, no interviews, no timeline. It's a decision taken in secret by the Security Council, which really means the five permanent members.
Like the Vatican, really, isn't it?
Where even the Vatican sends smoke signals. We don't even have smoke signals with the Security Council. It's terrible. But, you know, but there is hope. I mean, UNAUK, with other NGOs, we've been part of a campaign to transform that process. And for the first time in 70 years, the UN's actually agreed to adopt some basic HR practices and set out a timeline, have some interviews, have a list of candidates and CVs. And it sounds like a small reform when you look at all the problems that have been raised. But the Secretary General, if elected on this sort of broader mandate, would have, you know, would really be, you know, reporting to not just five countries, but hopefully 193, and to the world's people. If we have a say, if all these candidates come out and set out their vision, say what their priorities are, we have something to measure them against and hold them against. And I think that would have a hugely transformative impact. You look at what, you know, someone like Kofi Annan was able to do. He was able to maneuver within the confines of all the constraints to get this amazing deal with pharmaceutical companies to lower, you know, prices on HIV/AIDS drugs that saved millions of lives. Ban Ki-moon has been a big champion for LGBT rights. Mediation efforts by Secretary Generals U Thant and Dag Hammarskjöld were hugely important. So the Secretary General can have this transformative impact, you know, in both the symbolic ways, but also practical ways. And crucially, actually, just appointing good people. When the Security Council chooses who to, you know, make Secretary General, there's a lot of wheeling and dealing that goes on, and that results in key positions within the UN system going to particular countries. We can't say, oh, it's always the Brits' turn to have humanitarian affairs. It's always the French who should be in charge of peacekeeping. You know, we need to have the best people in post, and a better process would hopefully give him or her more opportunities to do that.
Charles, you were Assistant UN Secretary General. If you got the top job next year, what would you do? What would be on your list?
I would agree with you. I would bang some heads together. I think one of the big problems in the UN are the warlords within the organization, the UN warlords, the heads of agencies, the heads of some of the departments. I think a transparent process where there is some form of open selection could potentially empower the person taking the head position. Because right now, it's so secret that in a way, the Secretary General is disempowered. He's neutered by the process. But I think a process would do it, so I would do that. And I agree with you. I would review. I think one of the difficulties now with the UN is the remuneration and perks. but all the way to the top.
I agree.
Because it acts as a disincentive. What it incentivizes is to hold on to the position. And as a result, and you know, I have a good friend here who's lived through it, as a result, you have less and less people in the organization who understand the honor it is to carry a laissez-passer. And more people who just want to hold on to it because the thing about the UN, I would change the structure so that it doesn't become a golden cage with the door locked and the key thrown away. You know, it has to be an open cage and people have to move out of it. So I would definitely do that. I would bang some heads together. And then the third is I would undertake a number of... One of the big problems in the UN right now is its inability to undertake constructive self-criticism mm-hmm. in its operations. And I think there are a number of operations that have been going on, you've mentioned a few, that dramatically urgently demand an evaluation of relevance. Because actually the risk of the UN, the way the UN is going in many contexts, it's becoming increasingly irrelevant. And it's becoming an extremely expensive sort of irrelevant operation. And there's a need to really reflect on some of the failures and understand what the implications of a failure are on the perception of what the UN is, which means on the ability for the UN to operate afterwards.
You were saying something really interesting earlier, that there are two alternative ways SG can draw its legitimacy, either from a constellation of states, or you said drawing on the legitimacy of the Charter.
Or it's even within the UN, it's a debate, or when you talk to people within the UN, there are two views of what the UN is. And one view is the UN is nothing more than the collection of the member states. And so as a result, you can't do better because... But then there's another... there's another view, and I think some of us who were in the UN were more, is that the UN is the embodiment of the Charter. And the legitimacy, sort of the international legitimacy of that position are those two traumatic events that the West went through, well, more than the West for the second one, went through in the last century. And it's from that that the Charter derives its legitimacy, and for a number of us, it's from that that the UN official, it's from that the UN official is a servant, an international civil servant. But fundamentally, what the UN official is a servant to the Charter. And that's why you need to change the remuneration, because highly paid servants are no longer servants.
Yeah. Well, I hope you'll consider standing for the job of Secretary General.
But
you said a really important thing, which is respecting that position, representing the Charter, and then moving on. And I think one of the other key reforms in improving the selection process is having a single term for the incumbent, so that they're not beholden to again currying favour with states when they stay on.
Single term, 5 years?
My personal view is that 5 years is enough for governments, possibly enough for this position, but it's slightly longer even if, depending on someone needing to find their feet.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it's important, really, that they're there to implement the platform that hopefully they've been able to present to member states, they've been able to present to civil society, and to really get that job done without having an eye on what the US thinks of me and what the UK thinks of me and what Russia thinks of me.
And we shouldn't forget the WikiLeaks documents a few years ago clearly showed that the US was pretty pissed off with what they perceived as Kofi Annan's too anti-American, that's their view around Afghanistan, particularly Iraq in 2003, and they were looking to put in place, because that's America's perceived role, someone who is softer and more malleable, and they've got that with the current guy. Ban Ki-moon, I'm talking about.
Good point. Just very quickly, Julian, so you were in New York in September for the General Assembly, and also you spoke to at least half a dozen of the ambassadors to the UN Security Council. Did you get any hint of reform, change in the air, or did it feel a bit stuffy?
Well, reform, the hope springs anew every General Assembly, and the French thought they could get this thing through somehow, or at least wanted to make a play of putting this thing through where you suspend your right of veto in the case of mass atrocities. But yeah. Of course, it wasn't going anywhere because Russia didn't want anything to do with it. Mm. I mean, where there was some creativity was around the issues of transparency. I mean, the P5 was incredibly untransparent in the way it goes about business. And the P3 within that.
Are they proud of that when you speak to Samantha Power or Matthew Rycroft? Are they sort of proud of the fact that they're sort of...
Well, they don't put it like that. But you talk to the others. I mean, you talk to a big country like Brazil. And I talked to the Brazilian. He said, well, basically, for a lot of the time when we're not on the council, I have to act like a journalist, ringing people up, my sources, to find out what is going on in this body that's supposed to be making... You know, decisions on behalf of, and it's a very closed club in which people guard their privileges very jealously.
And bizarre that 80% of its decisions are about Africa, mm-hmm. and yet you get one, maybe two African members on at any one time, mm-hmm. if you're lucky.
Well, yeah, of all the things that they should be agreeing on, the five countries are always agreed on maintaining their power.
Right.
So one thing that unifies them.
Funny that.
Yeah, I guess I was raising the reason, apart from having lived there this year in South Sudan, but that really, I think, goes to the heart of very much what the UN has become, by choice or otherwise, where a state like that, as I said, if there was not a large UN peacekeeping force, which is a very inelegant way of managing a state... Putting aside also the NGO world, and I think really the two terms that come to mind, there's been an NGOization. You mentioned before NGOs have often picked up the slack, and that's true in many ways, but in many places I've visited in the last decade or so, you really see from Palestine to Afghanistan, often NGOs are doing wonderful work. There's no question about that, including in South Sudan. But often two things. One, I think we have a sense, mistakenly, that NGOs are not for profit, and many of them are. That's inherently problematic when you're going into a disaster zone or a war zone. And secondly, the sense somehow that you often believe your own bullshit, that you're able to go into a place and know better than the locals. And I've seen that time and time again. I'm not saying that's all NGOs, of course it's not. But in Haiti, one quick example, the American Red Cross, hardly a small organization. It emerged that when they were fundraising in 2010 after the earthquake, they raised heaps of money from American taxpayers. And it emerged in an investigation this year in the US press that they had virtually no one on the ground in Haiti when they were raising the money. So unsurprisingly, 5.5 years on, when there's an investigation into what they actually were doing there, what did they actually create? Put aside the fact that UN troops were giving locals cholera and not addressing it and actually trying to stop the spread of it, the American Red Cross hasn't really done anything with billions of dollars. And that's not the UN, but as you rightly said, these worlds become mixed unavoidably in a place like Haiti or in somewhere like South Sudan. And the UN, to me, is very unwilling, for all the reasons that's been mentioned tonight on this panel, to really look critically at itself. And to me, it's not surprising, although the reason member states, including the US, are giving it less money because of their own political reasons, the UN to me has to show why it does deserve money rather than just being a given that they do deserve money. That's how I feel about it, and seeing various places, I think many civilians would agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
I mean, just to make things a little bit more complicated, I think you know, when talking about the NGOs and the UN, there's also the whole discussion about humanitarian action, and that has significantly changed since 9/11,
for sure.
And the instrumentalization of humanitarian. So I would argue that humanitarian action in itself has morphed into a service providing. So the essence of humanitarian action has been lost by most. But not by all.
True.
So I think MSF, I mean, their Ebola response, mm-hmm. their CAR, the work they've been doing in Centrafrique, ICRC has maintained its distance. But I also think you're right, in terms of resolving conflict, something that the international community has lost broader is understanding how to avoid to be substitutive. That what has been lost over the years is, in a sense, what has been lost is a sense of solidarity with the populations, mm-hmm. and this direct link, and it's become far more of a machine But that's so that's sort of the...
Could I ask something? What about the situations where the UN has become a sort of de facto state? UNHCR particularly in Ethiopia, where they're the only people educating hundreds of thousands of young displaced people in the Palestinian territories. I know you've worked in that situation. Do you think that they are shining in that capacity, or that it's essentially an error that they should have ever allowed to
become that way? Well, see, the thing about the UN is it's not a state, because they don't have a political... They have no...
Elections?
Well, they don't need elections.
Well, that's true.
They're only a state in as much as they are accomplishing the service providing tasks of the state.
So is it a mistake that that's
happened? Well, no, it's just a reality. So that's where I think it's a misunderstanding. The UN is not involved in governance, you know, and states are responsible for governance, because the UN, as you were saying, the UN doesn't most of the time, the UN does not have the capacity to understand the context within which they find. They are not able to understand to a sufficient point the context in which they are in order to be able to focus on governance. I mean, they're basically service providers. When you look at the big peacekeeping operations, or even many UN missions, when you lead a UN mission, you spend 80% of your time feeding New York and dealing with the warlords, the UN warlords. You have less than 20% of your time to focus on what's actually happening on the ground. So I think it's making the UN look potentially better than it actually ever could be, because it can't function as a state. It just doesn't have, and when you look at the UN and you talk to the UN, they actually have no sense of functioning as a state. Yeah. Southern Sudan, I have to say, is a fascinating example. What I don't understand about Southern Sudan is how the UN didn't see the violence coming. And if it was functioning as a state, which meant that they would have been present, I mean, violence like that does not happen overnight. You see it coming. You see these tensions.
And the result now is that we have United Nations officials there incredibly unwilling to actually call out what the government is doing, because they're worried that if they're too critical, they're going to be kicked out by the government. Yeah. And this is obviously not common just to South Sudan. So there are undeniable war crimes being committed from the leadership down, military officials. And regularly the UN, for example, also patrols with government forces. That, to me, is deeply inherently problematic on its own. That I'm not saying every single South Sudanese troop is a war criminal, far from it, but there are inherent problems in the South Sudanese military to actually apply any kind of rules of war or humanitarian decency. So I've seen often in places like South Sudan, and for that matter Afghanistan, a real reticence by United Nations officials, including right at the top, to be, I would argue, necessarily critical, because they're worried about what's going to happen to their forces. And that's a degree of self-interest, which I understand, but it means that there's less chance of accountability for horrible crimes being committed in these places.
Let's stop it there and let's bring in our guests. Usual rules apply. If you've got a question or something you want to raise, then just put your hand up, maybe a brief introduction. If you're working for anyone in this or any organisation in this field, and we'll try and get through as many questions and points as possible. So try and keep your remarks reasonably brief. Thanks. Who's first? Got one at the front.
The question you are asking today, is the UN still fit for purpose, is to me a question that comes 70 years too late. You are too young. But I was a young student when I came to Geneva, and I lived there for 7 years. In those days, I knew nothing about politics. But I'm a musician by profession, and I used to teach young children from Latin American countries, because I come from Argentina, and I didn't first speak French or English or any language. I only spoke Spanish. And so I taught many children who were children from diplomats working in the United Nations. And from my conversations with all these United Nations people, and many I met from other countries in the homes, was that it was a club of nations that existed for the organization of wars in the world. I actually saw some diplomats become rich. I was there when the Angola civil war started, and how the ambassador changed his little car for a big car and changed his little flat for a big villa. And that was because he allowed his country to be destroyed for 27 years. And of course, if I start telling you all the wars I saw concocted and discussed their finances, and I knew ambassadors who would ask for money for their countries for to build schools, hospitals, roads, etc. And the rich countries, especially weapon manufacturing countries, would say, we can help you, but we can give you, say, $100 million, but half of them you have to spend in our weapons. And if you agree to that, we give you a commission in your pocket.
Thank you very much.
This is for me the experience of the United Nations.
But perhaps I could just bounce that towards Charles and say, is there a lot of this going on? Are there a lot of people feathering their own nests?
Well, but in a way, I wouldn't. I mean, I think I wouldn't necessarily say that's the UN. I mean, you're using Afghanistan. I mean, right now I live in Islamabad, and you know, I have a lot of friends I know in Afghanistan. I mean, that operation and the trillions of, or I mean, the amount of money that's gone in. I was in Afghanistan from 2001 to 2003. From what I understand of friends who are in there now, it's not much different. No. In terms of the actual development of the country. So I think it's not the UN, it explains why the UN needs to function, because it's self-interest.
But there is a culture within the UN, as you mentioned, you touched on earlier, a lack of self-scrutiny, and you have this investigative body which, if it gets tasked with looking into someone who's suspected of corruption, it will go into the dark room with a tiny torch, find the one thing it needs, report back, and try and hush it all up, rather than thinking there could be a wider culture here of bribery, corruption. We need to dig into this.
And yeah. The attitude towards whistleblowers sack the whistleblower.
Yeah.
Exactly. Which we saw with...
Which is pretty much how the US and British governments deal with whistleblowers as well, for that matter. But it is remarkably similar. I mean,
But I think it comes back to an empowered Secretary General, because it's part of the culture within the organization. Mm. And part of the challenge is to help change that culture. But you know, what's strong about the UN is that you still have a core group of people within who actually still believe in it and believe in the essence of what the UN represents. So there's actually something to work from. And if you had a secretary, I think this Secretary General has excellent intentions, but just doesn't have the drive to push them through. You had a Secretary General who had the drive to basically do nothing more than restate the charter and to make it as part of the culture that the UN rewards courage and courage and intelligence, because you can be courageous and stupid and that doesn't really help. It rewards courage and intelligence, but based on the charter. And I think you would see a significant change within the organization, because there's still there's still some people who fundamentally believe and want to hear that message from the top.
Yeah, and to your point, I think, about this loss of solidarity. I mean, if we're talking about reinventing the UN or scrapping it and starting afresh, I would have very little confidence right now with the International Committee having changed that we would create anything that even comes close to it, however imperfect it really is. I don't really have no faith in current leaders to be able to take that kind of far-sighted compromise. Gosh. And to reckon, and it's really bad, because now the level to which national and international interests really are converging and what happens in one country really affects us all, that is growing ever more clear, and yet we see leaders retreating into these sort of closer and closer national circles. But I think, you know, the UN needs to become more open, more democratic, and more better to sort of serve all the member states, which is what it was set up to do. So the system can be self-perpetuating, but it's often governments who prefer to, you know, fund the UN or fund their own aid programs as opposed to actually building up capacity, whether that's of the states itself or through NGOs. And the UN is in a very difficult place because, and I think governments feel this as well, because it's difficult for it to say no. It would be very hard for the Secretary General to say, oh, we can't really go and do that, member states, even though you want us to, because we're overstretched here, we don't have funds, or we're actually not very well suited to doing this. There's always this sort of idea that the UN has to take action, and that pressure comes from governments. So I think it does come back to governments, and it comes back to people in, you know, the rich and powerful states pushing their governments to make the UN work better and saying, we won't take this. We want to go back to that original vision of the charter. So it is, you know, ultimately down to us as well.
Do we have any more questions? Yes, we do. I'm going to go to the back there and then up the front.
Hi, I'm Isabel from the United Nations Association. There's been a lot of talk of rich and powerful states needing to come forward because obviously the UN is as good as its states. And there's obviously been a lot of debate in the media recently about the UK's status on the world stage. So while the UK continues to give generously in terms of humanitarian aid, I'd just be interested to hear more about the UK government's plans, for example, to withdraw from the Human Rights Act. And, for example, the fact that the UK, even though it's been a champion of the arms trade treaty, it was absent from the first conference of states parties. So I just wanted to talk a bit about whether the UK, as a permanent five member of the Security Council, is showing a tendency to withdraw from the world stage.
Julian, what do you think about? Should we be a P5? I say we. Should the UK be a P5 member? And if it is, does it not have greater responsibilities to live up to?
Yeah, I mean, well, clearly, we shouldn't. I mean, anymore. You know, maybe in the ideal world, that, you know, there'll be an EU rotating EU seat on it. No, UK increasingly is inward looking and will be in the next couple of years when it you know implodes over Europe and is becoming much less, you know, outward looking. On the security, in terms of involvement on the Security Council, it has its sort of pet projects. It put forward the resolution on genocide in Bosnia, but these positions on the Security Council are bequeathed from 1945.
You say we're the UK is sort of more internally focused. Is that a function of the current stripe of the government, or is that, do you think that's a kind of long-term trend?
A bit of both, I think. A bit of both. Inevitable, you know, post-colonial decline, and this government in particular is inward-looking, and the issue of EU is becoming all-encompassing.
Let's come to Ben at the front.
Thanks. I used to work for the UN in Sri Lanka, and now I make comic books, which is a well-trodden career path. And I wanted to ask about the mechanisms of the UN critiquing itself. And there's been a number of UN catastrophes over the years of Rwanda, of Srebrenica, and Sri Lanka, where I served. And Sri Lanka was a complete disaster of the UN, and we were in the last evacuation where we left 500,000 civilians in conflict. Charles, you wrote the report internally critiquing the UN and gave a number of recommendations of how it should change its systematic failures. And unlike the other two reports of Rwanda and Srebrenica, which were more a kind of narration of factual events that happened, the Sri Lanka report didn't look at individuals. It looked at the systematic failures of the UN in armed conflict to protect civilians. What's your opinion, 7 years on after Sri Lanka, and using Sri Lanka as the example, but really the wider system of where we are now with Syria, Libya, other issues that are going on where civilians are trapped, how has your report changed that systematic? Because they asked you, they brought you in as a consultant to write that report. They obviously wanted some recommendations of change.
Well, I mean, the first thing, since you've asked a question, you've spoken, and you're now a comic book artist. The first thing I want to say is how much I admired the fact that you were the only UN official in the Vani to have voted against the evacuation, and the evacuation was the beginning of the end of the UN's intervention. So I think it's people like you that make me believe that there is still something in the UN that is worth working with. It's a shame you're no longer there. In terms of, you're right, I led this internal, I mean, the Secretary General asked me to do this review with two other colleagues. Well, actually more, but the core team was three. Review of the UN's operations in Sri Lanka. And as you said, it was a dramatic failure, and as we got towards the end, and you could identify a number of individuals who could be held accountable personally for what happened, but then when we started writing the report, we realized that the individuals, you know, there was sort of a path to go down. You know, why were the individuals allowed to have such a prominent role in the failure? And it's because of the system. So there was a systemic failure. In terms of what's come out of the report, for me, the most important thing that needed to come out was a reaffirmation of the charter. And I saw people like you and some of the others in Sri Lanka and people I've met elsewhere who were just begging for the Secretary General to tell them that they were right in believing that the only reason they were part of the UN was because of the charter. The Secretary General did that, but it was undermined by a number of agency heads who sort of diluted the impact. So for me, that's the banging of the heads component. Rights up front is the policy that came out of the Sri Lanka report, which is putting protection at the center of a lot of activity. But there again, in a very UN-ese way, it's become very technocratized. And there have been, well, two things. I've just spent 3 years in Myanmar, not with the UN, but involved in the discussions between the armed groups and the government. And I've seen an application of rights up front that was not the lesson that the Sri Lanka report wanted to give, you know, a very technocratic. You raised the point. So the intention is good, the way is good, but what happened after the CAR child, the kids getting raped, and Anders Kompass, the very senior OHCHR human rights person, the fact that he became the center for the UN, he became the issue rather than the kids who had been raped, and the fact that UN didn't deal with it. For me, demonstrated that the culture is the same that allowed Sri Lanka to happen. That the culture of the organizations has yet to develop the right reflexes, because the I think it's senior leadership, and that's why in a way, you know, your point, and I've been thinking about it. How do you get senior leadership to understand that they need to change? Maybe through a change in incentives and remuneration, But the organization at the top, when there's a problem, continues to have the wrong reflexes. And the reflexes they have are very much a protective one and an identification of who to blame, rather than a forward-looking, grappling with the problem and how we deal with it.
If I can just add a quick comment on Sri Lanka, because I think it is an example, and I agree with what's been said before, but I think going forward in Sri Lanka, there is a role that is one of the unique contributions that the UN still can make as opposed to NGOs and governments, and that is supporting an accountability process and supporting a transitional justice process with a government that I don't think has the capacity to do so and possibly not the will to do so as well. And I think in those situations, it's the UN that can sort of provide that guarantee and some form of solace to the victims. I actually wanted to challenge it with what you said as well. I mean, I agree that Security Council reform is necessary. I'm not sure that the countries that are on there should not be on there. I think there should be more countries on there. I don't think who's on the council equates to it working better. I think those are two different issues. Mm. But if you look at even a country like the UK, where it stands diplomatically, its military power, economic power, we're still looking at, you know, top 10 on all these fronts in terms of global reach. And some of the candidates, that countries that might be on there, they don't yet have that. I hope they will do. But I think there is a role for the UK to play, which is why it's actually sad that the UK isn't engaging as much as it could. It is doing lots on aid. It's re-engaging with peacekeeping, and it, you know, works very hard at the UN in New York and Geneva. But in terms of having a clear strategy for preserving this UN system, which has ultimately cemented the UK in a power structure where it probably wouldn't be without it, it's not doing enough. And I think that is of, you know, great risk to people in this country and people outside. I think the UK needs to be a lot more joined up in its approach and prioritise investment in international institutions.
Thanks, Natalie. Who else wants to come in? Yes.
Hi, thank you very much. My name is Melanie, and I worked on sexual exploitation and abuse by UN peacekeepers in my master's thesis. I think this is probably one of the most morally abhorrent crimes that could ever be perpetrated by a UN peacekeeper. And while not trying to undermine the role of the individual in taking the decision to perpetrate this crime, I have found that it is very much an institutional problem. And as you've already mentioned, that there is this culture of impunity and maybe inability to criticize itself. The question is, do you think that maybe the lack of a standing army, a UN standing army, could have to do with that? Because the UN now is dependent on the contributions by the member states, and therefore I think the problem of accountability is reinforced.
Could we have a UN army? Who wants to come in on that?
Do we want a UN army?
Well,
be still made up of various, you know, troops from various countries. I'm not saying that, you know, country X is better than country Y necessarily, but I think you're right to the extent in Africa. I presume you were talking about Africa, but I guess you could have been talking other places as well, that there are certainly certain countries' troops that seem to have been in the last decade more likely to commit those abuses. I don't exactly know why that has been the case. I guess that's a lack of training or accountability. I don't know why particularly. But I think a UN standing army can be problematic, because I know the UN is also increasingly looking to outsource and privatise its security, which is a separate issue, but they're connected in many ways, because one of the things I've been looking at in the last years is very much that if the UN increasingly sees its security for its own people, and I guess its civilian bosses, etc., being protected by private security forces who themselves are inherently lacking accountability, as we've seen in various countries, if that's the mindset of where the UN is going, one can't help but think that some of the services that a UN standing army might provide could also be privatised. And again, not because a privatised UN army is inherently evil and a publicly run one is good, but the UN seems to be going down the road, as many governments are, of believing that they should take less and less of responsibility of things themselves. So if you outsource something, when something goes wrong, you're one organisation removed from actually dealing with it. And you see that time and time and time again.
I guess the advantage of having a standing peacekeeping force, though, is that the soldiers, at the moment we have a situation whereby you can get a peacekeeping detachment that comes into theatre and it's just been fighting a war at home. You could have troops who have PTSD, you could have troops who have no idea really what their training, what their background is, and a standing force might give you something more of a professional unit that would be able to accomplish itself a lot better.
Well, the other thing, I mean, in the ideal world that you have a standing army that it carries out the wishes of the UN, and you avoid a situation like Goma, where there was an Indian UN contingent there who was supposed to be protecting the civilians in Goma, and the UN hierarchy said, you've got to protect them, don't let them don't let them pass. And they rang up Delhi and they said, no, you know, stand back. And they stood back and watched, you know, the march into Goma.
I think they're sort of different. You've raised sort of different issues. I think there is a need, and again, there is a need within the UN to deal with impunity. And there continues to be great difficulty within the UN to deal with impunity, because there is this sense that the UN's got an incredible inability to work with embarrassment. You know, as soon as the UN, the institution, believes it's going to be embarrassed, it shuts down completely, and that's why it's not able to deal with impunity. And definitely, I mean, your cases are valid. You know, I can give you some other cases that would make all of us even more depressed. But there is that need to deal with impunity and getting a culture, getting a culture that understands that not dealing with impunity is actually a red line that's crossed, and allowing impunity within the organization is to allow a cancer to develop within the organization. So that's one. Second, in terms of troops and rape, I mean, the troops that were raping in CAR were actually very disciplined troops. So in a way, it's you know, when you've got, you know, when testosterone and these highly trained individuals, I mean, they're, you know, military are pretty, some, you know, very highly trained military do need to be commanded and controlled. So I think there's, you know, they were French troops that were accused of the rape.
Are there comparisons to military not working under UN auspices? Well, similar.
No, and then you get into the whole UN standing army and UN troops. I mean, I'm one who, I think there has been this review of peacekeeping, this report, but problem I have with the report is that it starts on the premise that peacekeeping's good. And then I think one needs to think through whether you actually do need peacekeeping. Because the problem with peacekeeping is it's become the default response. There's a problem, you send out peacekeepers. Without clearly understanding what these peacekeepers are able to accomplish, without clearly understanding what warfighting capability you actually have, you know, who are the troops you bring in to that area? And then, you know, then it's only, I mean, I think before one thinks about a standing army, one has to completely rethink the whole peacekeeping paradigm and the use of force and the use of belligerent force. And, you know, which goes further than just are they able to do something, that also goes into what do communities or what do belligerents start perceiving the UN as being in a context of conflict if they have troops that do war fighting. And in many situations, the war fighting capabilities of UN troops are laughable. I mean,
Can I say one very quick point about one issue that I think also is relevant about the prospect of a UN standing army, is that are they potentially going to be used for so-called humanitarian intervention? Now, that's obviously not peacekeeping so much, but we live in an age where many liberals and conservatives love this idea somehow of sending troops in to liberate people, which has been an unmitigated disaster basically everywhere. So if we're going to be thinking about the idea of UN standing armies to go in and maybe, what, liberate people, when we're told Libya, Gaddafi was about to massacre people in Benghazi, I mean, the Libyan situation, surely, if no other example shows that, I would say inarguably, but arguably shows that it was an unmitigated disaster.
But that was just an air campaign, wasn't it?
It was an air campaign, you're right. But is it not conceivable with the UN standing army that the UN major powers say, let's send in troops to assist in that situation? It's conceivable to me.
I think obviously that would be a huge concern. But what would happen now is you'd have the Security Council mandate someone else to go in and do that, as happened in Libya. So sure. I do think that's... I mean, I don't think, you know, a standing army will get rid of the culture of impunity. I think that's something that needs to happen through the reaction when it actually happens. Mm-hmm. And the French troops, you know, those are highly disciplined troops. I think the first cases actually happened when they weren't under a UN hat.
They weren't. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is a question that I think governments need to address as well. But I think where I don't think we'd get to a standing army, but where readily available deployable troops would make a difference is those points where we, I think, do still need peacekeeping, which is to respond to a really serious situation where civilians might die immediately and where an NGO or someone just simply couldn't do that, the sort of rapid response.
But 20,000 troops in Sri Lanka would have stopped.
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it depends. Well, I would say it depends what kind of mandate they had and the willingness on the ground.
Mandate is everything, isn't it?
You know, but I think...
And when they're deployed.
Yeah.
I mean, the 2,500 troops in Kigali on the 7th of April would have stopped the genocide.
Right.
But that's the thing. Right now, a peacekeeping mission is created. You can have several months elapse before it actually gets anywhere
near. But that's why if you have a standing army and if you have a more... Well, you need a more...
Subtle,
I think that
Security
army,
Council as well.
I think that army would basically be consisted of those troops that governments say that they would have readily deployed, and I think that's something all governments
should
look.
I'm sounding like a cheerleader for creating new armies. I need to go through some other. Oh, if anyone who's not asked a question before, not in their life, just in this room.
Hi, James is my name. I've been campaigning in support of the Palestinian people in Gaza in particular, but I've got my Free Palestine T-shirt. It's appropriate that Israel has barely been mentioned at all tonight, Palestine a few times. The enormous budget that's been expended on Palestinian refugees since 1948 is something which should be talked about extensively, and the way in which the United Nations has been content to expend such vast amount of money rather than politically address the situation, which is the mass expulsion of Palestinian people and the unresolved state of the occupation of Palestine, then the blockade of Gaza and what's happening on the streets of Palestine now. And to that extent, is the UN's fit for purpose goes right to the top, because if the political decision makers aren't making decisions to protect the Palestinians of Gaza and the rest of Palestine, then the UN is not fit for purpose.
Harriet, do you want to come in just on UNRWA and the work they've done?
We were actually talking before about the difficulties that UNRWA have. Obviously, it's the core UN issue, isn't it? It was their first mission, and the fact that it's still going is an admission of failure. They find it difficult to work in the region. They say they haven't got enough money, but it is also they're a balancing act. In some ways, it comes back to the de facto state. They've got responsibility for people and they have to work within the political confines that are there. I know when I was talking to some people at DFID, the UK department, they were saying, actually, we don't want the Palestinians to keep raising their grievances at the UN. We think it would be better if they kept quiet and we carried on with what they're doing. So I think they've probably
what
got...
What are they doing?
Well, keeping giving aid.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, Palestine really is arguably one of the best or worst examples, depending on how you see it, with the NGOisation of a conflict, where a lot of people, particularly the Europeans, the Americans to a smaller extent, have perpetuated the occupation for so long to benefit countless NGOs. This is something that many aid workers in Palestine will tell you. There are armies of NGOs and UN workers in Palestine, some of them doing important work, to be sure. But when
whom probably would want an end to the situation that they're in.
Well, I'm not saying that some of them don't, or many of them don't, but the truth of the matter is that you become part of a system by continually operating in an environment there where you know that you are not contributing to a resolution of the conflict. You're not even getting close to a resolution of the conflict. In fact, ultimately, the ability, I think, and this, I think, goes to the heart of the undemocratic nature of the Security Council, where Israel has been protected for decades, despite the fact that in 2 years' time, we have a 50-year anniversary of the occupation with no indication of an ending. And I think the UN's role in that, despite providing important education and other roles to Palestinian refugees who have been refugees for decades, the UN, I think, has made the decision through its major powers to not resolve this issue. Anyone I've spoken to, senior in the UN, about this issue says, we don't want to go there. It's too complicated. So ultimately, you say to yourself, well, how long is too long for an occupation to go on?
But if they try to get involved more politically, they wouldn't be able to do the humanitarian work that they do.
There's a risk that could happen. But to me, what NGOs, and I've argued this for years without much success, but I think if NGOs and the European Union and others said, we will not assist anymore with propping up your occupation, because that's what often NGOs are doing. They're propping it up. When Israel goes into the West Bank and destroys infrastructure, who do you think rebuilds it? Israel doesn't. NGOs rebuild it.
But that's the problem, isn't it? For sort of agencies that are supposed to play a palliative role, but by definition, they end up being part of the problem because they're allowing it to continue. But the alternative is to pull out, create a humanitarian disaster, create situations in which, you know, thousands and thousands of people die in the hope that this somehow will shame, you know, the US Security Council to stepping in. It's quite strong medicine.
And I think because in a way we're talking about different parts of the UN. I mean, we're talking about the Security Council, which is sort of where those issues, you know, where the politics of those issues need to be resolved. And then the UN is an institution. And, you know, and I think, if anything, the UN, you know, the frustration the UN feels or understands that it's actually a very small player in the politics. And it is trying to, you know, provide some assistance. I mean, one can say what one wants about UNRWA, but they are providing three services. I mean, the education, basic social welfare, and health and emergency support. They're not the only ones. The Palestinians themselves are also providing the same services. But in a way, for them not to do it would be to deny the Palestinians an understanding of what their rights are also.
And generations of Palestinians. Yeah, I mean, it's a fundamental question. Yeah. Do we stop something happening? Do we think if we let it go on somehow that things will resolve itself? I mean, that's a huge responsibility to walk away from all those people. I think you're right, the UN, you know, I mean, certainly when I speak to people at the UN, it's sort of the enduring kind of heartache and frustration that this issue hasn't been addressed. I think a big error was to have the UN be a part of the quartet. For me, the UN isn't US. It's above that. And I think one of the good things of the recent review on peacekeeping is that it talked about peace operations. So peacekeeping and force is a part of that. A big part of that is mediation. And I really hope that, you know, we will all admit the quartet process just needs to end, and the UN, I hope, will be able to make more headway in leading that mediation role. I think that is certainly a lot better than what's happening now. And there have been some attempts, you know, through the General Assembly to inch towards some sort of recognition. It's, you know, not a lot of solace for people on the ground, but I know certainly for many Palestinians, seeing the flag, Palestinian flag, raised at the UN headquarters a few weeks ago, having, you know, Palestine, you know, spoken about as a state, being able to join the International Criminal Court. Those are, you know, some steps that are providing some sort of hope, and we need to kind of keep going down that track.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to get too deep into Israel-Palestine because it's a whole different debate. Is there anyone from DFID in the room? No? I thought there was. In that case, I'll go to you, sir.
Graham, UNA, Newbury, very close to Didcot. Following the same topic, what is difficult to understand is why Israel are not adhering to international law, and why we hear so little about, you know, what pressure is put on and what goes on behind the scenes in tackling Israel on this. Thank you.
Well, I don't really want to go too much into Israel-Palestine with respect. I just think it's a completely different debate for a different evening, and as we've said, you know, that people feel it's a mistake for the UN to be part of the quartet, feel it should be above all that. But honestly, we could fill this room several times over and have a very lively discussion about Israel-Palestine on another evening. Check the website for details. Yes, over here. Do you want to wait for a microphone? Oh, you are someone from DFID in the room. Did you want to come back onto the idea of sort of where the aid money goes? I mean, there's been a lot touched on about funding of UN. You may not be authorized to speak, so we won't quote you. But if there's anything that you could say about...
Well, what I would say is that DFID and the UK are a huge player in the global development field. The biggest aid donor. And while Cameron... No, he's maintained the 0.7% donation when other countries haven't. So it's interesting, although they're not taking the refugees, that they are the ones pouring money into the refugee camps. So
I think the
one of the one things I will say that, you know, has touched upon is in terms of transparency. I mean, certainly it differed. I mean, that is becoming and has become over the last few years more and more important to us in terms of showing the British public where the money is going and following that through. And, you know, I mean, I've learned a lot tonight. Sort of dealing with the UN regularly is not something that I do in terms of my job. I'm in work on slightly different things, but that was, you know, was really interesting. And, you know, I think transparency, the more and more we have that, the more you can show what the money is doing, that it's not just going into, you know, lots of salaries for people who, you know, I've looked at UN salaries, they're massive. Yeah. And the amount of money you get to live in New York is a hardship. You know, it seems, you know, crazy in terms of, you know, when you have people living in Afghanistan and they get, you know, nothing compared to that for a hardship allowance. So I think seeing more and more in transparency is really important because, you know, as you said, I think inward is not quite the right way to say it, but the government is... It matters to them what the British taxpayer thinks, certainly from DFID. And in terms of, you know, explaining value for money, what this is doing, you know, amid an environment of cuts, you know, and other things. And, you know, trying to explain 0.7% spend 99.3% on ourselves. I mean, one of the ministers put it really well. Who does that? Who, as an individual, spends 99.3% of their money on themselves? Yet, you know, we still have a British public that we need to continue to make that argument with, and that's what we're trying to do.
Just one interesting thing on that I know Charles has something interesting to say on, is that at the moment, most DFID aid money does go through the UN, and whether or not that's right and whether it might be better spent through smaller groups... You were talking about that earlier.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think a lot of DFID money actually does go also directly to other implementing partners. But it comes, I mean, it's a bit like your Israel point. I think there's another debate that needs to be had about humanitarian action, about the UN's role, about how since 9/11 security, you know, the security regimes that different organizations are under fundamentally changes their ability to operate, but they still maintain that they're operating as they did before 9/11. I agree. But my point was that I think the UN, the operating side of the UN, needs to be extremely lucid and transparent in understanding what added value they bring in addressing a conflict situation, which includes the NGOs. And then what one needs to understand, the philosophical change that the humanitarian and the UN need to go through is understanding that it's actually the people themselves that find the solution. And that the problem with a lot of our actions, a lot of the interventions now, is we're substituting our own... The intervention becomes a substitution to the community's ability to deal with what they're dealing with. And since it's a substituting, most of it actually stays among ourselves, and ultimately the communities find some other way to operate. So there's a complete rethink that needs to happen for humanitarian action.
Just make a very quick point about these sort of fat cat UN salaries. I mean, they do exist, but, you know, this is again a member state decision to peg. So the UN civil service salary to the civil service of I think the highest paid civil service, which is the US. But I also know an awful lot of people who are not getting permanent contracts, who aren't making a lot of money, especially local UN staff, who are really not paid a lot at all. So I don't think we can...
And who represent a significant part of
exactly,
the
so I don't think we can generalise. And then a very quick point on DFID, its contribution. It is great, and it gives the UK an enormous amount of soft power and of real influence at the UN. And I think I would just, and UNA UK would just urge the UK to really capitalise on that, to make sure not just on the development side, but that we are pressing our advantage in transforming the UN in some of the ways that we've talked about this evening.
Right, anyone want to have the last word? Okay, let's take these two questions and then go home.
Yeah, sorry, mine will be quick. And I may get this wrong, I just know from dealings with UNHCR that a lot of the people that I work with in different countries don't pay tax in that country. So PSFR was based in London for a long time, a lot of people, good salaries, no tax. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about Haiti, for example, examples of good governance come from taxpaying members of the community. Now, if we were able to pay tax in the countries that the UN was operating in, that kind of starts a good governance conversation.
Is that a quick, easy win? A bit of tax from UN officials?
You get into a legal, because it's the whole Vienna privileges and immunities bit, but in that sense, I think it's a very complicated issue, but approaching it differently, as I was saying before, the problem with UN remunerations is a golden cage, and that's what I've seen people. I've been in situations where a critical decision needed to be made that went against the interests of the hierarchy, and the person who I admire tremendously backed down, because he was told that if he did what he was proposing to do, that we were pushing to do, it was in Somalia in 1993, he would lose his job. And I remember that one evening when we were sitting together in Mogadishu, and he was telling me, I come from Guyana. I had to struggle to go to university. I have three daughters who are currently in university in America. I lose my job. I lose all of the education grant. Can I afford, do my children have to pay the price for a position of principle that I've taken right now that I know is not going to work? So, I mean, it's sort of not really making my point, because I do think the education is good, but it was this sense that somebody was in a cage, and because of the remuneration, was not able to walk out of the cage. So it has to be completely thought through differently.
Really stark example. Sir, last question.
Hi, my name's Steve, and I'm a nurse working in public health. Anthony, you make an interesting point about how the NGO, aid sector, and even the UN prop up failing states around the world, when actually, in fact, what I believe is stronger governance needed. So the question is really, do you believe that the UN should be playing a much more central role in support and governance of strengthening governance in states?
I generally feel uncomfortable with either players playing major roles in states, not because they're inherently bad, but because it seems to be one can be seen as quasi-colonial. I think a lot of people I've spent time with, Haitians and Afghans, particularly Haitians, they feel their country's occupied by the UN. There are UN troops there who have been there for years and often have committed horrendous abuses, putting aside bringing cholera to the Haitian people. I think that the international system is problematic because in country after country, I can think of at least half a dozen, Haiti, South Sudan, I'd say Palestine in many ways, I think I use the term, they're fake states. They're not really real countries. I'm not saying they shouldn't be countries. I'm saying that the way in which they're set up, the support that they have to receive to stay even sort of afloat from NGOs and the UN means that almost by definition, the power of the governments in those countries is minimal or non-existent. That is a problem. So the idea that an unelected NGO boss in London has incredible power over what is happening in, say, Haiti, that to me is inherently bad. I'm not saying that those NGOs can't be doing good work there, but ultimately there's not really a question of accountability. People on the ground in Haiti, in Afghanistan, in South Sudan, who I've spoken to over the years, routinely say, we'll appreciate getting food or water or shelter from this organisation because it's a matter of life and death, of course. But ultimately, we feel that we're often not getting the benefits that we're claiming, that they're claiming we should be getting. And more importantly, who do we go to when something goes wrong? There's no one really to speak to, and the people who are often working there are the ones who are low down the food chain, who haven't got the power to do much because they're based outside the country. And that to me is it's weird in a way that I think many on the more progressive side of politics like the idea that the world has developed to the extent where NGOs, in apparently more enlightened ways, are going around the world helping people. And there's a form of truth in that. But it's also kind of evangelical as well, putting aside the religious aspect to it, that we somehow have this arrogant belief based in the West that we know often more how to deal with problems than in those countries. And I've heard time and time and time again in all those places plus others that locals are routinely not talked to or asked what they want. That's such an obvious, basic thing.
You always mentioned the failing places. You could have mentioned Cambodia, Namibia, Burundi. I mean, there are these success stories where the UN has gone in and has done governance to start
well,
with, and then elections.
The UN war crimes trial has been a disaster in Cambodia.
Well, that's a different issue. So I mean, it's not, the UN doesn't tend to broadcast its successes very well.
And I also think there are different issues. There's the provision of services, you know, helping people, and then there is the issue of governance. And there are, you know, and I think supporting local governance is something that you know, again, it's the approach that you take, which is essential, you know, because governance exists. I mean, when we talk about governance, there's no single situation where you don't have some form of local governance. The challenge is how do you get these local governance structures to be respected and interact with regional governance and then central governance, but they exist. Yeah. But the other issue that I think is, and that comes to the peacekeeping side, I think one of the big problems we have, the international community, is that we're still stuck with a template of governance, and it's a template of central governance. You know, it's a strong central government that projects in contexts where there is no central government. Definitely. If you look at Somalia, you know, more than 20 years they function without a central government. You look at CAR, you know, they've never had governance. I mean, you need to create governance. You look at Afghanistan now, Iraq, Libya, Syria potentially. So you have these situations where the connecting points for some form of central government no longer exist, and these peacekeeping missions have as part of their mandate to reestablish strong central government, and conceptually it can't work. You know, you're because the other thing about these fragmentation of country of a state is that the fragmentation mostly many times is done on ethnic and homogeneous. So formerly heterogeneous areas become homogeneous as people move out because of the insecurity. So when you're projecting the authority of the central government, in many situations, you're projecting the authority of an antagonistic component of the government. And so I think, but you know, how are you going to, you know, to differ than the others? How are you going to question the nation state model?
I think what the UN can do is at the international level, and it comes back to the point I was trying to make earlier about it creating norms and standards, and you have Universal Declaration of Human Rights, you have, you know, a new development framework which has a big focus on governments, on governance. Those are things that at the international level all states have ostensibly signed up to. So the UN can help by creating those standards. It may not be perfect in implementing them at the national level, but certainly at that level it can raise the game. And also hopefully through the provision of services, empower people to the extent that they can themselves can play a role in building up their governance system within that country. I think ultimately it's that at that international level and the empowerment of local people where the UN will hopefully be able to make that difference.
Okay, Julian, a last word?
Yeah, very briefly. I mean, we've spent a lot of time up here sort of slagging off what the UN has done in all sorts of ways. But what struck me as being in New York just this month is that everyone comes to the UN and expects the UN to do things for them. Every leader, when there, it's still, despite all the problems of the Security Council, the most important sort of source of legitimacy for international action. And it demonstrates that people around the world, no matter all the failures, notwithstanding all the failures, they want to believe in something that is there to represent something above their governments and their states, some form of embodiment of universal values, you know, the UN Charter. And that, you know, if the UN can be, you know, the UN has to be there if it can better supply and respond to that need, then, it can justify itself and become fit for purpose.
That's a really good place. I'm going to have to leave it.
It's an opportunity for the new Secretary General. There's an opportunity to reform the organisation. Mm-hmm.
So it's a really after this, I never work with you when they did. That's a really good place to leave it. Perhaps not fit for purpose, but maybe we should all try and make it so. I want to thank the panelists for their wise words this evening. I want to thank everybody for coming. I'd like to see you at another Guardian Live event very soon. But for now, have a safe trip home. Thanks very much.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.